Good afternoon and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson and you're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. We're coming from the Driftless area. We're a community radio station. And this is a show about food. Who's in the Kitchen? And my guest today is Ryan Wagoner. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad to have Ryan. This has really been fun because Ryan is the founder, the dreamer of Driftless Provisions, which is a producer of fine, cured, smoked, non-smoked charcuterie type of meats. And it's right here in the Driftless area in Viroqua. And when I first met Ryan, he was just kind of dreaming of this business, starting out in his basement. And actually, I was amazed to find out that he, as he's producing these really wonderful meats now, that he had not really done that or even learned about doing it. It's something that it came to him just a few years ago that he'd like to do it. And he went running with this idea. So I want to talk a little bit about just the history of his business. Also, we're going to be talking about, you know, just getting a business started and you know, encouraging people to take those steps and, you know, find the suppliers and find the monetary support and what's out there in the community, like Vernon Economic Development Association, which is certainly has really helped our food industry out here, but also just with the challenges it there is now in the production of food and especially meat products. How to, you know, navigate? I mean, there's just huge companies that produce cold cuts, as we call them, or deli meats, and so how does a little mom and pop business kind of get into a place, find a place, and be able to compete and abide by their ideals of high standards and sustainability and so forth. So we're going to talk about this today. And so again, Ryan Wagoner is going to be my guest. And let's start at the beginning. Tell me about your dream. I know some people might have heard this story, but it's pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah, certainly. Excuse me. Strap in, folks. That was a lot of topics, so we're going to be here for about 24 hours covering all of that. It's a saga. This dream, if you will, started in 2015. I was still living in Milwaukee, and some life changes were coming about, and I was in an MBA program in Madison, the evening UW Madison MBA program, and I thought, I would like to do something different. As a civil engineer, I was finding life somewhat boring, so I decided charcuterie. A lot of decisions came and went, or thought processes came and went, but and ended up in the food business because I love food, and I love creating something with my hands and my intellect, if you will. So the food world was. Just kind of calling me, but I hadn't spent much time there at all, except for being a hunter and a fisherman and creating items with, you know, my harvest. But once I started looking into charcuterie, in the state of charcuterie in Wisconsin, I had eaten summer sausage my whole life, and I had just a couple slices of a nice dry cured salami, and I was like, "This is world changing. This is life changing for me." And as I looked into it, there wasn't a lot of makers, so I thought,
"No."
When
we first moved to Wisconsin, I said, "Is there any other sausage besides brats and summer sausage?" It seemed like there's so much, you know, especially, you know, having been acquainted in Europe, yeah, about the great, great, or maybe just even living in New York City or something like
correct
that.
The coast in Europe, yeah, you know, you could find charcuterie. But in the Midwest, there were some smaller things popping up, but it wasn't, you know, as big as it is now, and it's still not that big. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty fortunate to have been, you know, kind of on the leading edge of that, not necessarily the leading edge or the first to market, but we've certainly caught a wave that is still happening in the salami world. Charcuterie wasn't on people's palates or language, for that matter, 4 years ago. And
we just called it lunch meat, yeah, I guess. And it was just sort of extruded stuff, I guess, that had flavors added to it. I mean, sort of mystery meat.
Correct. And there was a huge stigma in the U.S. with non-cooked meat. So the process of salami is fermentation and drying. You never cook it. And a pork product, it was something that should always be cooked. So to this day, some of my Amish, you know, friends out here will not eat salami because I tell them it's not cooked. And it was, nope, I'm not going to touch that. It's still in the kind of culture that it should be cooked.
So it's not cooked, but it's definitely gone through a process that makes it safe to eat.
Correct. Yeah, a long process. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, fast forward between moving out here in the fall of 2015, working at what was then Driftless Meats and More, for, you know, 4 or 5 months, learning how to make sausage in general, not salami, but just a bratwurst or a hot dog. Working at the Driftless Cafe, kind of helping develop that program for salami there, and then breaking off and creating Driftless Provisions in 2019 now.
Okay. Driftless Provisions with your own physical location.
Correct.
And manufacturing plant. Correct. And all that. Yep. Stuff. Oh my gosh, but that must have, where is that and how did that come about?
Yeah, it was a quick process. I joke. That was obviously 2015 and 2019 is 4 years of dreaming and scheming and development of recipes and just figuring out how to make a business work. And then 2019 came. I was done at the Driftless Cafe, and you know, this is a capital intensive business, so it takes a ton of money just to get equipment, get a space, get certifications. The certifications are actually, I think, free, but all the things in line to be able to be certified is very capital intensive. So moving out here without knowing really anybody and not coming from money myself, I just had to network and create this idea. But then once an idea is created, that's fine, but you have to convince other people that your idea is a good one. So that took a quite a long time. And without, you know, making at the Driftless Cafe allowed me to actually put product in people's mouths.
Wonderful.
And that was a huge, huge breakthrough for me to see, okay, I can make something, I can give it to somebody, they can eat it, I can see the reaction on their face, and okay, we've got something here. They are understanding the difference between summer sausage and this product, this Italian style or French style or Spanish style. And they will spend money on this. So that is the basis for a business, right? You have a product that people will spend money on. And then it was how much? How much product can we make? How many people can we convince that this is worth spending money on? And you start to scale from there. But initially, if we had tried to like take a piece of salami, give it to somebody. In fact, one of my early investors tried my product and didn't like it. And they liked, he told me maybe a year later, he's like, I actually didn't like your salami at all. I really liked you. And I believed in you.
Oh,
so
gosh.
So that was kind of interesting to hear. And I was like, oh, okay, well, at least I've got that. I've got me. And I think our salami is good. But I had to convince people that, you know, just the initial startup was worth their investment, whether it be $10 or $10,000 from certain folks. But we didn't actually have any of that right away. We went and we ran a Kickstarter, we need to make salami somewhere. We found a co-manufacturer, and they said, yes, we'll make salami for you. We don't know our capacity, but give us your recipes, you know, be here when we make it, walk through with us how you do it, and we'll make it for you. But this is going to cost, you know, $10,000. I think it was like $20,000 for that first run with packaging and everything. So we ran a Kickstarter, and that was 2019, spring of 2019, and we were able to get product onto the shelf to further, you know, educate, you know, who our clients would be, and then, you know, sort of impress, if you will, future investors to say, yes, this is selling. Everything that we make, mm-hmm. we sell, and here's the profit margin. Here's all the things that we're doing in order to put these steps in place. Now, of course, my eyes were huge, very wide, saying we can be, you know, making $4 million in 2 years if we do this right. Well, that was a dream. I don't know if those numbers are accurate from what I was actually thinking, but, you know, when you have this idea of a business that I had in 2015, 5 years later, I had product on the shelf, and 4 years after that, here we are. Now we are coast to coast with product, but it's still a battle every day. It's a battle to get new accounts, to service the accounts that you have, to make sure that the manufacturing is going correctly. And then, as you alluded to before, there's big players in this game, and we are a small fry, and we need to constantly be, you know, pivoting or making small changes to make sure that we're relevant in this world. And it's not easy. It's certainly not easy, but it's entertaining, mm-hmm. and fulfilling.
Yeah, I'm really very impressed with your ability to have the vision and to understand all the aspects. And I'm thinking, did the MBA actually really help you? Or do you just have these instincts? But it seems like you really had an idea about marketing and business and, I don't know, insurance, yeah. and safety and all that.
I do think about that a lot. And to be honest, yes, of course, it helps. It helps to have reference points. It helps to have contacts. And it helps just to have the credentials at the end of the day to talk to folks that they might know you, but they don't know you that well, and say, well, I've got this, and this, mm-hmm. Experience. I've been making for this long. By the way, I have my MBA. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's not the top thing that I say to people. It's not mm-hmm. even on my email signature. You know, so it's there, but it is certainly useful when I need to call somebody and say, hey, you were in my class, or I met you through this program. So that has come in handy quite a few times.
But I mean, the actual information that you got from your training, I mean, did that help too?
One-on-one relevancy, probably not. You know,
it seems like you have an instinct for this then.
Maybe. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So let's say when you opened Driftless Provisions, then where was your actual physical location?
Our house, essentially. We were just renting a house. My early business partner Justin and I rented a house in near Chaseburg. So we ran pretty much everything out of there. The nice thing about salami is shelf stable. So we could ship and package out of our house any product that we had. Now, we quickly realized that wasn't actually a smart way to go about it. So we rented a small space in the Food Enterprise Center, and we packaged and shipped out of there. But shortly after the pandemic started in 2020, we came about the actual facility that we're in right now.
And where is that?
That is in the Food Enterprise Center up on the north side of Viroqua.
Okay. And this Food Enterprise Center is part of the Vernon Economic Development Association, and it's correct. Just an amazing idea in itself.
Yes.
And I have talked with Sue Noble, who's the director of it. It's a really private, organization. It isn't government funded or anything. And she has done, Sue has done a lot of work with helping people to start their own enterprise. That's the idea. And it's the idea that food is something we have out here. This is what we have. We have a farming community. We have crops. We have food that can have value added. And so the Food Enterprise Center is a place where businesses can lease a space, have it built for them, or have it, you know, equipped the way they want it, if they want smokers, if they want refrigeration, freezing, whatever they want, they can get that made for them. And it's a huge building, an absolutely huge building, and it has docks so that there can be deliveries and pickup. And taking something that was just kind of just foreclosed on, I guess, an old building, which was the National Cash Register building. Mm-hmm. Now a number of businesses have gotten a good start there, and I guess it's just much more financially feasible to work with a building like that than to just kind of buy or rent a.
We wouldn't be here anymore. We would be done as a business had it not been for Sue, the Vernon Economic Development Association that started and that building, and of course Sue's board of directors as well. But that building, like I said earlier, the amount of capital it takes to just start this business and so many different food businesses is a huge inhibitor. It's a hurdle that's why not many people jump into the game to begin with. They might have an idea. They might create a recipe at home. Somebody says, oh, you should go on Shark Tank and run with this, right? And then they look into it for maybe a week or two, and they say, this is impossible, especially from a location like Viroqua. It's a small town. If you go to Milwaukee and you want a commercial kitchen, you could probably find something. You can moonlight at a restaurant that is certified commercial kitchen, and you can make there until 5 a.m. and then, you're out of there while they're coming in to prep for the day.
That's what some of those businesses are doing.
That's what a lot of people
do. Yeah.
Yes, that's what a lot of people do. But in a rural setting like we're in, a commercial kitchen is few and far between. And we're lucky. We have Gaze Mills and we have the Vita building here. But even still, that's not a lot. There's a lot of people here, there's a lot of food coming from here. But I was super naive on that point. When I moved out here, I said, I want to start a meat business, and I want to do it closer to the land. The land, the animals, the farmers, part of our tagline, if you will. And I just didn't think about that aspect of it, that the infrastructure is just not in a local community or a small community like this. So it took us a while. We, Sue didn't have a space originally for us. She had blank space, but in order to do a build out there, we had to raise the funds for it. So we're talking anywhere upwards of $1 million to build out something that we're in now. And of course it was built out for us. The previous tenant had gone under, and so we were extremely fortunate. Whereas had we not come into that space, we didn't have another space and we didn't have the money to build something.
No.
So we would have been under. We would have been
so
done.
So what kind of build out did you have to have done in order to move into that?
The space was certified food safe, but the floor was not viable for us. If you washed the floor, it ran out to the sides and actually under the walls, and it would have been a disaster. So we had to put in a big grease trap and floor drains. But other than that, it was that and equipment. So it was almost set up, ready to go. Some plumbing here and there.
So what kind of equipment do you need?
So we've got a big big sausage grinder, a big mixer, and a big sausage stuffer. That was like the initial pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Once sausage is made, it has to ferment the salami. So the salami got put into a specialized room that we had imported from Italy, new to the game. We came about this system
humidity
that was humidity
and
temperature controlled and airflow. So we had these two modular units that we bought from Italy, and they worked. They were fine, but they were small. They were meant for a smaller operation. And for us, we thought it would take us closer to $1 million in sales, but once we started using them and seeing some inefficiencies that they had, there was no way it was gonna maybe have us break even, and that would have been it. And
so you have to think bigger, don't you?
Constantly. And yeah, I'm in that kind of mindset right now where, you know, we did a bigger build out last year where we have the capacity now for, you know, the very first system had a capacity of about 1,200 pounds hanging salami at one time, 1,200 pounds of green weight salami, mm-hmm. meaning fresh salami. Once it dries, it would be about half that. And again, that wasn't enough to sustain us. So we did a huge fundraising round. And at the beginning of last year, we did this build out that was completed in, I think, September of 2022. And that allows us to hang a capacity of about 15,000 to 20,000 pounds at once. So, I mean, over 10 times the amount of salami.
Right. Well, then, who's making this? It's yeah. not just you anymore.
No, you've got
employees.
I just cut payroll today, maybe our biggest payroll ever. So
that's a huge thing. That's a huge part of your expense, isn't it?
Huge. But it feels good. It feels actually really good.
So you're an employer in the area.
Yeah. We've got, and I think a lot of our investors, you know, I might have a great idea and I might be able to make some money down the road and make them money. But most of, if not all, the investors were like, this is great for the community, as far as it's a product coming from a small town, but it's also going to put a paycheck in people's pockets. You know, feels great. It feels really good. So it's supporting my family. It's supporting.
That's great.
Yeah.
One sausage at a time.
One salami. Every sale counts. And we've got 6-7 people on payroll right now. So.
That is amazing. Well, I'm talking with Ryan Wagner of Driftless Provisions. Just in 4 years, he's come from just making, you know, learning to make sausage in his basement. Cured meat, and then working gradually through different businesses where he could kind of plug in and learn and share his recipe and have the product made, to actually finally being in his own space and making and producing a lot of product and marketing. So anyway, I'm talking with Ryan, and you're listening to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and we're coming from Driftless Community Radio, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet. If you're interested in hearing this program again, this interview, or any of the other programs that we've done, many of them are now podcasted on our archives at wdrt.org. So I'm interested in this money thing because, and investors, these investors are, how does it work? I mean, are they getting any kind of interest? Will they get a payback? Do they want, you know, are they just kind of like, well, someday maybe I'll get my investment back? How does it work?
A combination. So we've had probably 4 or 5 different models of raising funds at this point that we've gone through. And all of them are unique in of themselves. Investors are never guaranteed, for one. But at the end of the day, some people are taking home, you know, interest payments now. Some people are just hoping, and maybe not hoping, but, you know, of course
they're willing to wait.
They're willing to wait and play that game of, hey, we've got a piece of something that might turn into something more.
You don't actually have stock.
We do have equity shares now.
Okay.
Yes. So the first fundraising thing that we did was a Kickstarter. You know, we got on that platform, and it was roughly $20,000 at the end of the day that we brought home, and that got us initial funds to fund that first round of production, packaging material, and that was it. And naively, you know, new business owner, hey, $20,000, we'll get it going, we'll sell the product, and then we'll take that money and we'll buy more product and we'll just keep going. That seemed logical at the time. What I didn't understand at the time was, before the product is sold, you have to start making more product, and, you know, on and on and on. So right now we have probably $100,000 some dollars in inventory, Well, that didn't happen by selling salami and then gaining a little bit of profit and putting it back into the business. So, yeah, so the Kickstarter was one thing. And then a lot of private notes. So we, my background through Camp Manitowish YMCA, I was a veteran before that in the Marine Corps, I was active duty, but don't really have a ton of contacts from that have helped with this business. But you know, the Camp Manitowish connection has been extremely valuable.
Could
for
you
me.
Say that more slowly?
Camp Manitowish.
Oh, what does that mean?
It's a YMCA wilderness tripping camp in northern Wisconsin, so Boulder Junction. It's an independent Y. And I worked there from 2007 until 2013. And three of those years I was full time. So almost every summer from 2007 until 2010, I went up and I was a counselor for 1 year. Then I was a trip leader in Wyoming for a month long trip. And then I was a trip leader in Alaska for 45 days in 2009. And backpacking. And in 2010, I started doing more administrative roles and setting out trips and training and equipping and all of that good thing, all that good stuff. And then I was the Wilderness Program Director from 2011, 12, and 13. And that had everything to do from recruitment to training, risk management, and sending trips out. And it was a life-changing experience for me, but obviously the children, the 10-year-olds to 18-year-olds that go through the program, it's extremely life-changing and formative.
And then you realize that different things that you've done in your life have really been preparing you.
Oh, absolutely.
In many ways. The same thing happened to me in education. Mm-hmm. And you look back and you will go, every job I had, everything I did, you know, prepared me for the next step.
I was telling my 2-year-old son a story two nights ago, and I was explaining how I knew somebody, explaining how his mom, my wife Kristen, and I met. That's how it was, and I was going back and saying, well, then this happened, and that brought me here, and then of course this, and so it was like this huge story, and it brought me all the way back, and I was like, I can't actually start this story anywhere in, you know, definitively. It was when I was born. And even before that. So it's kind of funny how one thing leads to another, but I really can't pinpoint anything definitive for how I really got into Manitowish. But the experience, for one, but then the network I've gotten from that has been incredible, incredible network. And wow. I've got investors, I've got equity partners that have come directly from my Manitowish connection.
That is amazing. And of course, all those kids that you worked with, they're grown-ups now. Isn't that interesting?
One of them just put in Canada. I think the fires are a little bit to the west of him, but he just put in Canada, leading a 45-day trip to paddling in Canada. And one of my other participants has also led a 45-day trip with Manitowish. So yeah, full circle. Very, very cool experiences.
You have really affected a lot of people.
I hope so.
Yeah,
in a good
different
way,
different groups of communities. Yeah, really interesting. So I'm thinking of different things. Marketing is a huge part of this. I mean, you can't, like you say, you can't just keep producing the same amount. You can't support yourself. You can't support your inventory. You can't support your staff. You got to be making a certain volume, and then you got to find out, where am I going to sell this, and how do I do that? And so, tell us a little bit about the whole marketing thing. Transportation. Oh my gosh, storage.
There's a lot to unpack. But the marketing aspect is front and center right now in our business. And I guess I'll give you a little background. I can go out and make a sale. I can walk into any Hy-Vee across the Midwest here, or I can walk into any co-op really and say, hey, we've got a local, you know, Wisconsin-made salami, you know, at Eyes Brighton, and well, let me try it. And then Eyes Brighton a lot more, and they say, this is fantastic. Our packaging is on point. You know, everything looks good, and tells the story of a local producer, right? And that opens doors, 100%.
Wonderful.
And wonderful. Yeah, so we were super fortunate to have that in the it's not necessarily hyper local to Viroqua. It's sort of a movement across the country that is, we want to support local. Now, whether people follow through with that or not is one thing, but you at least get the door opened and you have those conversations. And as we go through, you know, in 4 years of business and as our sales grow and people start to see us elsewhere, more doors are opening, which is great. Mm-hmm. It's what we want. Now we'll buy from you. It's $300 to get on a shelf. It's great. Get on a shelf, and then what? Then you have to move the product. So we are a premium salami company. You know, our salami is not cheap. There, you know, the overhead costs, the staffing costs, the startup costs, all of that factors into the price point of our salami. And you can only go so low before you're just giving it away or you're losing money. So we go almost as low as we can just to get on the shelf. And once we're on the shelf, they have their markup. And if it's through a distributor, the distributors have their markup. So we're our price point on a shelf, on most shelves, is around $10 for our pork salami. Well, if you take a look at some of the other salamis on the shelf made by Columbus, which is Hormel, or made by Boar's Head, which is owned by, I think, a private equity firm, they're half the price for twice the, or they're twice the sausage, same price, or maybe even a little bit cheaper. So you're getting more sausage through that company for the same price as our sausage, our salami. Now, that in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, I don't want to be Hormel. I don't want to be a Columbus where I'm using the cheapest pork I can find, trying to speed up the process as much as possible, and just undercutting value through quality. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the game that we want mm-hmm. to play in. So we are a premium brand, and we want to be. However, with the economy that it is the way it is, and people's wallets are a little bit tighter. So when they're walking through a store and they see sliced salami, or they see, you know, a Hormel that's, they don't see Hormel, they see Columbus that looks nice, it's packaged nice, or Boar's Head that's packaged nice. That's all they're seeing, and besides the price point. And they'll pick it up and buy it. Now, they may buy ours once in a while, and that's all we really need, mm-hmm. just a piece of that pie. But in order for them to make that first purchase, what do we have to do? And we are 100% running into that right now of, how do we market ourselves on the shelf so that people pick us up? If you walk into any Sendex store over in Milwaukee area, you would think that Boar's Head owned the store. They've got marketing everywhere. They own the coolers. They've got end cap, you know, big displays everywhere. It says Boar's Head. And then, you know, you might find us in a basket somewhere. So we are up against these monstrosities of companies that dump millions of dollars. Somebody told me that Boar's Head dumped $30 million into advertising alone. Advertising and marketing in Wisconsin last year. $30 million into Wisconsin for advertising and marketing.
Oh, mercy. How can a small person compete right? with it?
So that's what we're running into head on right now, is how to move once we're on the shelf and how to convince people that you know, a $10 salami is going to be way better than a $8 mm-hmm. salami, like way better. And not to toot my own horn, but it just is. It just tastes better. You mm-hmm. put them side by side, and the quality is outstanding. But it's something that we're just running up against. So,
well, they have to try it.
Yeah, they have to try it. So, I mean, there's sampling programs.
It kind of sell itself way, but how do you do sampling programs?
Yeah, we try to rely on the delis or the cheese departments to cut it up and sample it out, and we give free salami for those cheese departments to do that. And, you know, there's a lot of things out there. I think we gave up almost $10,000 worth of salami in the month of May to do sampling with all of our stores.
Oh, my gosh. Are you the main marketing person, or do you have someone hired to do marketing?
Yeah, my wife, Kristen.
Oh.
So she does her marketing as well mm-hmm. as raise our 2-year-old full-time. So she's got a lot on her plate, and she does a tremendous job. But we're limited by budget, obviously. You know, if we just don't have a ton of cash to throw at it, but there's grants and stuff. So we just got a $10,000 grant from WEBIC.
What's that?
Wisconsin Women in Business, I believe. I should know that. I'm so mm-hmm. sorry.
Okay.
But they, it's not only women. I'm veteran. So veteran minority groups is who it services. So I was able to apply for a grant there. So we just got that yesterday. And that money is meant to go towards marketing. So we're designing and building these standalone little display shelves. So they'll go into some of those Scenic stores and maybe some of the festival stores or Hy-Vees. And it'll actually, you know, it'll tell more of a story than just our little package. And the little package tells a great story and it looks nice, but it gets lost amongst all of the advertising, you know, by the likes of Columbus and Boar's Head. So that $10,000 won't actually go very far in the development and making of those, but it's a great start. And we had applied for a Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin grant. We did not receive it this year, hopefully next year. But then there's a LFPP grant. It's a USDA grant, a local food processors grant, something like that. And that's $100,000. And we are waiting on that. And that's all marketing dollars. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that comes through.
Right. Well, I do want to spend some time just on your product, mm-hmm. what goes into it, where you get your ingredients, and how you really are trying to, you know, be sustainable, have something that's really, truly healthful and not contributing to a lot of pollution and that kind of thing. So, but let's just talk about what kind of sausages and things do you make, and what goes into them, and why are they special?
Yeah, so all of our salami has pork. Even our exotic line has pork in it, and pork is just the main ingredient. It tastes really, really good when you put it through this process. There's no other way around it. We go back and forth with different processors for our pork. So we use Red Top Farms. It's a company based out of Missouri, but they have most of their farms are in Iowa. It's just where most of the pork is made in this country, and it's right across the border here. And then Birkwood Farms is also an Iowa farm, and that's I don't want to say conglomerate. It's a consortium of farms, maybe. But the most of those, Birkwood and Red Top, I believe, have about 12 farms that raise for them.
I see.
So they're not huge by any standards, by Hormel standards, and you know, antibiotic free, growth hormone free, vegetarian fed, gestation crate free. They're the California Proposition 11, where they're requiring so much gestation mm-hmm. area for sows. That went into it didn't go into effect yet, but it got upheld by the uh-huh. Supreme Court a couple weeks ago.
So this is not strictly organic, but you can't
Correct.
Use that word. But you are using practices that would be considered more sustainable and more humane animals.
It's a humanely
kind of
raised, mm-hmm. a humanely raised line, Berkshire pork, 100% Berkshire pork, and we've been extremely happy with the quality
we've gotten. What is Berkshire?
So
it's a
heritage breed. The meat itself is going to be a little bit more marbled and red, and the fat on it it's creamy, but it's not a super soft fat. We've got a lot of heritage breeds that are out there that are called quote unquote lard hogs. And actually, I have a lady from Indiana dropping off in about 45 minutes here, dropping off pork from her farm. It's a Cooney, which is a lard hog, and she's hoping for us to make a line of salami for her farm, which we also do. So,
that's a way of marketing, huh? It's just through people's own farms.
Correct. Uh-huh. So working with, we work with a lot of, you know, local producers that want to have a different value-added product for their farm. So it might be hot dogs, it might be summer sausage, and it also might be salami. And knowing that we are one of two or three salami makers in the state, we're pretty, you know, sought after for, for things like that.
Well, what strictly makes salami?
Salami is just a process. It's a process of curing and putting up, you know, typically pork, but it can be beef or lamb or bison or elk or venison. And
you have your secret ingredients as far as seasonings.
Yeah,
and so forth.
you have a certain salt content that's going to inhibit a lot of things. But you're also putting in a simple sugar, dextrose, and a starter culture into that product. And through the fermentation stage, the starter culture eats the dextrose and it kind of off gasses the citric acid, or produces citric acid. And that citric acid is going to lower the pH of the salami. So if you ever eat a piece of salami and you taste a little tanginess, that tanginess is from the citric acid that's created through the starter culture. Now, over the course of only 24 to 36 hours, the pH drops. It inhibits the growth of any bad bacteria that might be in there, Salmonella, Listeria, E. coli, things like that. It's going to lower that pH. They might not die, but they're certainly not going to reproduce at that point. Then it will hang in an environmentally controlled room, humidity, airflow, and temperature, and it's going to hang there for however long it takes to lose about 35 to 40% of its weight. So a 1 pound salami going in is going to weigh, close to a 60% of what it started as.
So that just really intensifies everything. I mean, just
correct.
Concentrated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's no getting around the flavor profiles once it's dried. There is no water, extra water to kind of wash off your palate or dilute anything. It is meat and fat and spices. So it's super great in that context. And that loss of water also inhibits any sort of growth of bacteria. And that those three main steps, you know, your salt, your drop in pH and your lower water content, it creates a shelf-stable, delicious product.
You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can go to listen to this and previous shows. This is Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and I'm talking with Ryan Wagner about Driftless Provisions, a local business right here in Viroqua, homegrown, really homegrown, and it's still kind of a mom-and-pop place because I guess you and your wife are really the heart and soul of the business.
It
does really help to have a family that can help support it in the beginning and do the work. This is what family businesses are.
my son Aldo is only two, so he's not, or turns two in a couple of weeks, but yeah, he is. Yeah, he's not able to mix and grind meat yet, but I think it's close. He's a taste tester.
Well, good. Well, and I wanted to clarify that this isn't the kind of meat that you just, you know, put on a sandwich and take it to school for lunch or something like that. I mean, a lot of the lunch meat we think of is for sandwiches. Mm-hmm. And my impression of this meat is that you really eat it piece by piece. It's very intense. I mean, I don't know if you could even eat a sandwich of it, but it's dry, it's almost hard. And you put it on a charcuterie plate.
Correct.
Like at a winery or at a party, or you feature it and you taste it and you have other condiments along with it that enhance it. And it's just not the kind of thing that you get in the grocery store and just, you know, it's already pre-sliced and you slap it into a sandwich. And
it's never cooked, so that protein is not breaking down, so it has to be sliced super thin, either, you know, on a charcuterie board or if you did want to put it on a sandwich or a or a pizza, if you slice it too thick, it's the mouthfeel is off. So it needs to be sliced super thin.
Can you put it on a pizza? Is that a good way to use it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We make a pepperoni that's almost the same steps as a salami, but it does go through a low temp cook step. But you know, sitting pretty farm here, just outside of Viroqua, it uses our pepperoni. Luna Valley Farm uses our pepperoni. So there's you know, that is a salami of types, and as long as it's sliced pretty thin, it's fantastic.
I'm glad you reminded me, because I have bought it and maybe sliced it too thick, and people just feel like, oh, like you say, a mouthfeel.
The mouthfeel.
You really have to chew it.
Yeah.
So you want it really thin.
Yep.
Yeah.
And when, so you know, a lot of people want a pre-sliced line, and that's another marketing and financial hurdle to overcome.
It pre-sliced?
We have one location right now, which is the Viroqua Food Co-op here, but it's a test run, and we don't have the slicing capabilities, so we have to find another meat processor that can do it and package it and have it exactly the way we want it. But you know, people are looking for convenience, and they want what they want. And if it's a sliced line, and we have the means to do it, we'll entertain, you know, two or three different varieties, I think, at this point.
Well, hey, I love a really good sourdough bread, but man, if they will slice it for me, that crust can get really hard, you know, and you're sawing away, and none of the slices are even, and so.
Yep.
Yeah, the local bread company came out with a, you know, bread slicer, and boy, I think they're selling a lot more bread because of it.
Yep.
It's really handy. Yeah.
I was at a family gathering over Memorial weekend, and it, you know, we were making pudgy pies, and I was like, "Oh, we've got our spicy finocchiona." And I pulled one out, and I was trying to slice it, and it was dark out. Of course, I had some beverages and whatnot. And after about 5 minutes of slicing, I was like, I didn't have a sharp knife. I was like, I'm sick of this. Why is there not a slice line of this company? And I kind of chuckled.
Yeah, we have a meat slicer at home. Actually, my husband got really into doing his own butchering and some, you know, meat curing and things like that. But it's very handy to have a good meat slicer. I have one, an antique that I got that's just, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just with a handle. That's but great. It does slice the meat really thin. And it's kind of like the commercial slicer that you, when you have your meat sliced at the deli.
And if you get into the salami world and just are, you know, kind of an enthusiast, you know, I love putting our salami in different applications. So pizza is one of our, you know, our top, but slicing up a sopressata real thin or tiny chunks of it and tossing it into a fresh pasta salad is super great.
Oh, yes. I like getting some ideas. Go on with that.
Yes. In the summertime, our chorizo is my favorite. It varies throughout the year, but what my favorite is, but the chorizo in the summertime, all the paprika and spices, and it just pops with the heat. Any salami should be eaten room temperature, by the way. All the flavors really come out like a good cheese.
So how do you use your chorizo?
So chorizo, I'll toss it into a gravy in the morning. So I'll make biscuits and gravy with it, and that's the best, by far the best. Uh-huh. So now the gravy is going to turn a little bit red, and it's not going to probably look like a traditional gravy, but the flavor profile is fantastic. And the pizza topping, you don't need to use the finocchiona or spicy finocchiona, but those two go really, really well. And then our Greek style lucanica, that can be also tossed in a pasta salad. It's got cumin and orange zest and a lot of garlic, so that one's also super fantastic.
Oh, now you're giving me some ideas of how to use it, because I just think of slicing it, putting on a meat tray.
Yeah, that works just as good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Get creative.
Be creative, yes. Hey, send your ideas back when you have because, you know, when you get, say, a CSA box and you get a bunch of vegetables that you don't know how to use, it's really handy to have a few recipes
Absolutely.
How to use this.
Mm-hmm.
So Do you have recipes, actually?
I'm not sure if any are listed on our website. We used to do a salami of the month package, and we would send out.
Oh, I wondered if you did that.
Yeah, I think we've quit the salami only of the month, but we do have a meat subscription. But the salami of the month, we would send out the salami and then a recipe for that salami, other than just a charcuterie board. Now, I will admit it gets difficult to come up with new recipes every single month, and I think we did every other month or something like that. But you know, that was decently successful, and it was just fun to figure it out and make a recipe. So
you do have a subscription service, and you mail out.
We ship salami everywhere.
It's
nice that it is dry cured and shelf stable. In the summer, it gets a little bit difficult. Some people don't like getting meat in their mailbox when it's 80, 90 degrees out. But I assure you it's safe. It might be greasy. It will be greasy. Mm-hmm. So the look of it deteriorates a little bit as it gets super hot. Mm-hmm. But we still ship just every 50 states.
Oh, yeah. Well, so tell us how people can get in touch with you and how they might be able to subscribe to your...
Yeah, we have a website, driftlessprovisions.com.
Driftless, and, say it slower.
Sorry, Driftless Provisions with an S .com. And find out all about the company and the personnel and our products. You know, we are, and there's a great where to find us portion on the website.
Oh, great.
So
that's
if you don't live around here, you live in the mountain states, or you live in North Carolina. We just picked up a bunch of stores in North Carolina. Find it down there. Yeah.
This might be a good Christmas gift to send to people.
Absolutely.
Either one package or a bi-monthly subscription.
Yeah. One-off. The COVID era was pretty big for packages to be sent. You know, parents weren't traveling to see their kids or vice versa. So there was a lot of packages bought then. You know, the business in the holiday season, that has kind of dipped again, probably to pre-COVID levels, I would assume. But it was quite fantastic for a little while there, and gangbusters at the onset of COVID, when people were like, well, we're not going to see you for the holidays, but here you go. Here's a charcuterie package.
Oh, great. Well, you know, you really have ridden the wave, several waves in the food industry, I think. Just having done this show for 11 or 12 years, Jim, would you say? Is it 12 years now? Doing a food show? I mean, it's just amazing how Americans' awareness of food and issues and quality and that kind of thing have happened. I mean, it's just a lot more less provincial and more interested in, say, things that are you could get in Europe and so forth that we haven't had available. Or if you lived in a large city, you could get things, but not in the small towns. You'd have sort of the conventional food that was available. And now I always comment, you know, now you can get a latte at the local gas station in Viroqua, a town of 4,000, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, people are very aware of just, I don't know, finer food, getting quality and paying for it. And also, people are interested in local. This idea of local has really taken off, and people are concerned that, you know, we should ship food all over the place, and wouldn't it be nice if you could get something that's locally made, and interested in the stories, like I order the Sitka salmon shares from Alaska, because that's you know the stories of the people who you know are small fishermen, and they get wild caught fish, and of course then we do have the packaging, and we are able to send things frozen or refrigerated by mail, which maybe, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, really just nobody even thought of doing that. And now COVID made us aware of being able to order a lot of things by mail, and the internet, of course. Just concerned about where your food is coming from. I mean, there's just so much more of an awareness of this. you know, is it organic? Is it sustainably raised? You know, what is the quality of the product? And are the you know, there's a certain amount of people who want to know that the employees are well taken care of, mm-hmm. and that, you know, that just better business practices. And yeah. so people pay more for coffee if we know who the growers were and they were paid adequately. And so all of this stuff is really developed, I would say, you know.
People have money for the things they want, uh-huh. a good friend of mine always uh-huh. says. And I think that's true. And there's a lot of, there's an education piece still. And there's a point to be intentional about how you buy. And if you can't find something, ask. Ask your local grocer to bring it in, because they actually do. It's amazing.
That can help. And, you know the businesses say, well, this is what the consumer wants. So let your local businesses know. You can let your local businesses know that you're interested in a product that isn't on the shelves. And they go, yeah. oh, I didn't know somebody really wants that. Yep. Wants to come in and find it and didn't have a special order or something like that. So I have just been having a wonderful conversation with Ryan Wagner, who's the founder and operator, CEO of Driftless Provisions, which is a local charcuterie company here in southwestern Wisconsin. And the products are available all over the country now. So, and a list is available on their website at driftlessprovisions.com, where you can find out where this product is for sale in other states and so forth. So thank you so much, Ryan, for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and we're on every Saturday at noon, so I hope you'll tune in again to hear more about people in the area who are interested in food, food policy, food preparation, and just eating good food. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next week.